Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. I'm Tali Nauman, and I'm your moderator today. We're doing the panel discussion called Native Tribal Nations Take a Stand. And, of course, that's ... for the environment. I'll just introduce the panelists real quick, and then we'll ask your attention for a welcoming song. This is Leon Briggs. He's the cultural ambassador for the Seneca Nation. Mm-hmm. And so as such, we're actually pretty much his guests here. And Jenny Monet is another environmental journalist and from the Laguna Pueblo in the southwest. So we'll each have a little bit more to say about why we're sitting up here, and then we'll have the discussion after we have the welcoming song.
This is a song that's used to open programs and stuff. It's called Recalling of the Elders. When we speak with seven generations past, seven generations in the future. So what we do is we ask for all of those who have been past, you know, to come and join us to be part of who we are so we can allow them to be part of our future.
On your way, no one no. On your way, no one no. No one no, no way. No one no, no way. On your way, no one no.
Thank you, Leon. That was beautiful. So my job here is to reiterate some of the rules for our panels, for starters. And, of course, we will allow no less than 30 minutes for questions on the big part or discussion, whatever you people want to contribute to this panel. The ones with the blue tags, the journalists have a priority in asking those questions or making those points after we finish our little presentations up here. I have my own independent business called Journalism to Raise Environmental Awareness. And as such, I am the contributing editor to the Native Sun News Today for environment and health. So that's based in Lakota Territory. Inside of that, they have South Dakota and the town of Rapid City. So we're actually the largest weekly in the state of South Dakota, if that's worth anything to anybody. They're in the flyover zone. And so I've been covering the Dakota Access Pipeline resistance and the previous pipeline resistance to the KXL, Keystone XL Pipeline, Canada, from Canada. And I think that issue is what kind of inspired this panel to be formed. It wasn't my idea, but I was asked to moderate it, and that particular environmental issue really got a lot of traction in the media and with the public all over the world. And so what we know up here is that it's just the latest and just the proverbial tip of the iceberg as far as the red road of resistance in protecting Mother Nature. And we'll be talking about the other similar struggles that have been going on for a long time and that will be going on. One thing we all have in common is that we, as the three of us, were all there at the spirit camps at the Standing Rock Sioux reservation boundaries during that resistance, which occurred from April last year until February this year. Each of my panelists will let you know what they've been working on before we go into the questions. And I would also like to mention, besides just what we're doing in here, why the people that aren't here. As you probably noticed for this panel, Winona LaDuke was originally going to be on the panel. And then in the updated biographies, you would have noticed Gary Doerr, who is the tribal elected tribal government chair in the Nez Perce, which is overlapping Idaho. And so we would have had people from the northeast and the southwest and the northwest if he could come. But it's really quite astounding that that Leon could be here, for example, because like them, this is the fishing season. This is the hunting season, and that's part of the in relationship with the environment and sustainability that they come from. So actually, Winona went home to go fishing. It doesn't sound, you know, like, oh, whistle, I'm going to go whistle and fish. It's not what it is. She has to be part of the part of that. That's how important the environment is. And Gary just basically he's fishing too, but they use spears or gaffers, and Leon will tell you more about that. But I just wanted to throw that out, and I also acknowledge you folks. I know that you are here because you really care about this topic. It's not like you just casually came in here, and I really, really appreciate the effort that you're putting out to understand what these folks will be talking about and in whatever you have to share, too. Thank you very much. Everybody here is here as a volunteer, and we really need to pat ourselves on the back for that. Thanks a lot. So, Leon, would you like to do a little explanation of what you're working on, how you work, and what's going on with you?
Okay, my name is Leon Sam Briggs. I'm in rural Tonawanda Seneca from upstate New York. my Seneca name is Hoyt de Gejas, which means he helps always. I am people call me a Seneca elder. I'm a traditional craftsman, and I travel to a lot of the different reservations, different communities, teaching a lot of the traditional crafts. Unfortunately, in a lot of the communities, especially out west and down south, a lot of these communities have lost, the touch of, making bows, doing basketry, pounding the splint, doing stonework, doing carvings. So that's what I do. I do a lot of reproduction pieces and stuff for museums and for movies. And I'm also part of the Haudenosaunee Reenactors Guild, which we are natives that play natives in movies. One of the programs and stuff I deal with a lot is the Haudenosaunee's Environmental Task Force. I did send a couple copies of the letters and stuff that we sent from the Seneca Nation and from the Haudenosaunee Environmental Task Force and stuff to President Obama and stuff on our traditional treaty rights. One of the things that we have with these violations and stuff, especially environmental violations, these go back to our traditional treaty rights. And one of the things we always ask the attorneys and stuff and these lawyers is, have you changed the Constitution? You know, have you personally changed it within the last 5 minutes? Because these treaties have been listed in the Constitution, and they're listed, and they say as long as the grasses grow, the grass is green, and the waters flow. You know, and that's, to us, that is going for eternity. So that's one of the things that I do is, you know, travel. I've been to Standing Rock for quite a few years. I've been a lot of places out there, Fort Yates, Little Eagle, Fort Paula. And one of the things that I do is do a lot of the as a cultural liaison in helping them regain some of their sovereignty. And what we work on is decolonization. Through the decolonization, we're teaching our sustainability. You know, on traditional harvest, one of the things, you know, like I said, you know, Winona and them aren't here. We have traditional hunting and fishing rights that are guaranteed to us by the Constitution through these treaties and through some of the different treaties like Fort Laramie and these that give us, you know, supreme right of the land. And with that, we have a short amount of time within to do, especially our fish harvest. When we're harvesting salmon, walleye, perch, and stuff for our sustainability for our communities, we have a short amount of time that we're allowed to traditionally harvest them. And then it becomes the time that we have to compete with the longliners, the sports fishermen, and the commercial fishermen. So that's, you know, to us, you know, this is, if we do not take part in our traditional upbringing or our traditional rights, you know, we're actually, you know, giving that away. So that's why we do what we do to stay sustainable.
Thank you, Leon. Yeah, Jenny?
Okay. Thank you, Leanne, and thank you for that beautiful opening for all of us. It was very nice. Guazi, hello, my name is Jenny Monet. I'm a tribal citizen of the Pueblo of Laguna, which is a tribal nation in New Mexico. I'm also an independent journalist, and for the last 10 years, I've really exclusively focused my body of work on indigenous peoples around the world, also here in the United States. It's perhaps one of the most underrepresented streams of storytelling in our industry. And getting these narratives out there, particularly with one of the most highly exposed stories like Standing Rock, was not easy. I've traveled the country this year explaining to a lot of people my experiences at Standing Rock in a variety of levels. On February 1st, for instance, I was arrested while covering a water protector demonstration, and despite producing my press credentials and leaving the scene when asked to leave, I was still detained for 30 hours, verbally accosted by the jail captain in North Dakota when asked for my phone privileges, which I didn't get for 25 hours. And once I was in my holding cell with other women, I realized that white women were spared the humiliation of being strip searched, but that Native American women like myself were not. And that experience of being arrested was something that became this game-changing, eye-opening experience even for me, who had been writing about the environmental racism and the legacy of that racism that existed in the Dakotas. And now here I was experiencing it firsthand. So I liked what people had to say this morning in the plenary, because it did bring race into the fold of this narrative when we talk about earth justice. We're here talking about environmental justice. And so I begin my remarks talking about how I, as a Native American woman, was arrested and wonder if it was because in this climate that we're living under and Trump, whether I got arrested because I was a journalist, because I was Native American, because I was a woman, because I produced press credentials that weren't recognizable by, say, a legacy press, but rather a nonprofit press. I have a lot of those questions. And the reality is, it was probably all those things. So I frame my remarks today based on that backstory and that foundation. I spent six consecutive months reporting from the indigenous-led movement at Standing Rock, which at its heart was a story about treaty rights. And it took a long time to get to that core understanding to a lot of outsiders looking in, who first were engaged by the novelty of these quote-unquote spirit camps that were forming on the borderlands of the Standing Rock Sioux Indian Reservation. And that, of course, was about an environmental struggle itself to save the Missouri River from the perceived threat of an oil pipeline crossing under that would potentially destroy the only drinking source of the Standing Rock Sioux. In itself, it was an environmental story, but it was so much more. It became a story about the militarization, about protecting these corporate energy projects. I had just come off of reporting in Honduras on the eve of Berta Cáceres' assassination. It's believed that I got perhaps the last interview with her before her death, before hired hitmen barged into her home and killed her. And while she was running for her safety in the month between that time where she was hiding for her life, I couldn't get an editor to report on that story until after she was dead. And the struggle continued in trying to get people to write about Standing Rock. Attack dogs on leashes that were used to used to control the crowd of water protectors who had scaled a fence to try to effectively stop construction on lands that water protectors had deemed sacred. A scene that we have not seen since the 1960s in a civil rights era. I couldn't get editors to want to write about that. And that continued over and over. The narrative of just trying to get this narrative out there in and of itself is a story. When we talk about environmental justice, we have to start taking a real strong look at our newsrooms. Because I, firsthand, fought for every one of the headlines that came out of Standing Rock for the six consecutive months that I was there. I made five trips from September 3rd, the day of the dog attacks, to December 1st. I drove up with a caravan of veterans and moved to the reservation because on election night, I stayed up all night unpacking what this meant. What does a Trump presidency represent for this struggle? And it was my first piece that I put out there after just doing as much digging as I possibly could, and I had made a determination by the time that the headline hit that I knew I had to get up to the reservation because things were going to get messy. And they did. And guess what? Nobody else did that homework, because after December 4th, when the Obama intervention happened, which I can explain later, but it effectively stalled the pipeline and advanced a call for an environmental impact statement to be conducted, all the media were there because the veterans were there, and they went home. And there was the day I got arrested on February 1st, I was the only credentialed journalist on the scene. They never came back. It gets repeated over and over again. And my job right now is to keep whatever that momentum was on December 4th when we had a media circus on the reservation and say, there's a Standing Rock, not only, there's a story still at Standing Rock because the pipeline, while oil is flowing in the Dakota Access Pipeline, the fight isn't over. But meanwhile, there's a Standing Rock in lots of other communities, and not just tribal ones. And so it's from this conversation that I share with you today that I can certainly shine a little bit more light on the kind of impact that this one recognizable moment in tribal community has had in many ways for other tribes. Standing Rock was not just a struggle for one tribal community, but for all the tribal communities who have and are defending the treaty rights that Leanne's discussed. Thank you.
Thank you, Jenny. I think we could have named that panel what you just said. There's a Standing Rock in lots of other communities and not just tribal communities. Mm-hmm. It's a very poignant story that she has to tell. I was the person who started coverage of resistance to pipelines years ago. At that time, TransCanada Corp out of Canada wanted the Keystone 1 and XL pipelines for tar sands oil to go through our nation's heartland, and that's the United States, down to export this stuff to other countries. Well, they bought out all the newspapers in the whole Great Plains with these giant flashing green lights ads, newspapers, radio, television. It was just going to happen. You know, it was a given, and only reporting about it was that it was going to happen. Fortunately, I worked at a publication and worked at this publication that does care what Indian voices have to say. And I was allowed to cover that before, years before the Dakota Access Pipeline became the next resistance. So some people have asked why this was so big a deal and why did it make the international front page news. It started way back then, and actually many don't remember that the Keystone XL pipeline struggle also was front page news after we got it going at Native Sun News Today. And so, well, that speaks to the importance of small media, that we can get things going from the ground up. We have our ear to the ground. And Jenny mentioned that she was wondering if one of the reasons she got arrested was because she was a woman. Was she an Indian? All these reasons that it could have been, and that it was all of them. I think that I was not arrested when I was on the front lines at Dakota Access Pipeline because of my card-carrying white privilege membership. You know, the private security company Tiger Swan that operated there had these guys, thugs, in big unmarked cars, and the first thing they did was when I was stopped on the public right-of-way to take pictures of the construction, was swoop down on me, these two big guys, and oh my God, out there in the middle of the Dakota Plains. And they said, you can't park here. I'm like, dude, if I can't park here, you can't park here. But what? I'm not going to say that, you know. So then up behind comes the highway patrol, when I'm from South Dakota, you know, that's the state jurisdiction that I'm from. And my license plates are South Dakota license plates. So the next people were South Dakota Highway Patrol because they had called in Highway Patrol from all over the country. And I said, oh, hi, guys. I'm just a good old boy from South Dakota. And, you know, I was like that. I can do that with them because I'm white. And I didn't get arrested. So that's the inequality there. Her website, her Facebook page has her standing with a sign that says, journalism is not a crime, where she's on the front lines of the Dakota Access Pipeline. But she mentioned Berta Casares, and she's the Honduran gal who lost her life. It was an environmental issue, but seen from Berta's point of view, it was just protecting the land and the water for her family and her livestock. And there's any number of people that have been in that position, and any number of journalists that have tried to cover it who have ended up in the same way. You know, I guess what I would like to go on from there with is kind of a preface to the preface that I want to make is, how is it different to be in indigenous water protector, or you know, what is environmentalism in an indigenous community or to an indigenous person? That what is different about that? And I, you know, would say you got to start with the fact that these communities and cultures are tribal and depend on the food source, the water source, directly. We're land-based. I'm the only, like, I'm the token non-Indian on my newspaper. So, I'm land-based, but, and I'm the 2% of the people in the United States who actually live in a rural sector. But we're land-based. We tribal communities not only need the food and the medicine that comes from the land to carry on their tradition, but that means it's a carry-on and cultural. It's cultural survival. And so it's not the same for them. Global warming, well, you know, it really actually affects the fish stocks and everything right there on the ground. So it becomes a spiritual issue. It's a survival issue. And then on top of that, there's treaty rights that they have already mentioned here. The Constitution of the United States, which was taken from his people's, their own laws, based on theirs, tells that treaties are the highest law of the land. This is like, okay, that means that North Dakota State Constitution, they call it the Century Code, is inferior to a treaty. But that hasn't been recognized yet. And so that is what the struggle is about a lot for the local people, rather than a struggle for climate. I mean, the climate faction, the 350.org, then, and those who came afterwards, they're not using Native Americans for their cause. Native Americans championed the cause, and these other issues are on top. They're widening out the dialogue for that, for the issue. So I would like Leon and Jenny to continue with speaking about what the environment means to them, what and coverage of the environment means to them. What do you see as an indigenous viewpoints on conservation, basically?
Do you want to go first?
The viewpoints on conservation?
Well, you can call it conservation or in environmental activism or protection or any of those terms. I mean, it's really a land issue in protection of, in fact, just the right to be. How would you put it? In your words.
Well, there's a lot of conversation right now in this conversation about treaty rights, and I would just probably start there by saying that, you know, I think to a lot of outsiders and people who are unfamiliar with indigenous ways and call it activism or struggle, you know, they see treaties as maybe these old dusty relics of the past, when in fact they're living, breathing documents. And the practice of treaty rights, we don't call them treaties, really, when we're talking about consultation or when we're talking about negotiating compacts or tax codes or any kind of grazing or fishing rights, you know, with states or the federal government. And those conversations and those kind of deals, those negotiations, they're happening every day. If you're paying attention wherever you're living, Pacific Northwest, the Dakotas, up near upstate New York, in Seneca and Oneida territories, these conversations, these moments with lots of different bureaucracies and governments, these government-to-government sovereign relationships are unraveling every day. And they're because of those treaties. But we just don't call them that, right? But that's what it represents. That's what Standing Rock represented at its core. Consultation. That's where Standing Rock hinged, was that the U.S. Department of Army stepped forward and finally said, you know what, we need to acknowledge those treaties. Standing Rock hasn't been fully consulted about the dangers of this pipeline to the water supply that is protected by this 1868 Treaty of Fort Laramie, right? That never went away. And so when we talk about these struggles, covering Indian country, I tell a lot of people when I'm talking to a room full of journalists, covering Indian country is more than just what's happening in the present. It is a story on a story on a story. And it requires going back 150 years and understanding why those agreements that were made more than a century ago are still effective in 2017. And it's a lot to unpack because there's a lot of other dilemmas that had happened to create a situation like Standing Rock, for instance. You had another environmental justice issue happening in the 1950s when the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers flooded Standing Rock's most fertile bottomlands. And that was a breach on the treaty agreements. And do you think the tribe has forgotten about that? It sent them into cyclical poverty. It's one of the reasons why Standing Rock, like many other tribes, are some of the most politically underrepresented groups of Americans today, living in some of the most segregated environments. They have the worst voting rights in America. They can't go and vote with their tribal citizenship ID, which is a valid form of identification to cross international borders. And yet when they want to go and elect their native leaders, one of their own who ran for Congress last year, they were restricted. So these treaty rights are everyday practices. We just don't call them that. When we're talking about land rights struggles, I would also just say that, you know, we're here talking about environmental justice. Obviously, there's a big attack on tribal lands everywhere. And when you talk to other tribal nations that are dealing with certain issues, whether it's over Bears Ears, the monument at Bears Ears, whether it's Oak Flats, whether it's the Mauna Kea in Hawaii over the struggle over a telescope, what the outside narrative often reduces the story is to a quote-unquote sacred land struggle. And that's a real disservice, because it started out that way for Standing Rock, too. Oh, the lands are sacred. And why that's problematic is because it mysticizes indigenous peoples. We're somehow these kind of spiritual beings void of any rights, constitutional rights, the supreme law of the land. And so when people want to latch on to these narratives, which oftentimes get regurgitated without digging any further to the actual meat that is there, it's likely because they haven't done the homework. And guess what? Reporting from Indian country is a heavy lift. Always. Unless you're covering the low-hanging fruit, cultural stories, which we're so done with. That happens all the time. Because they're easy. It's easy to talk about and write about Native American culture and traditions. It's a lot harder to get at the root of why these struggles are happening. And I guarantee you, it is beyond just sacred lands. That's important. Spirituality and that connection is important, but there's so much more to that. And the backstory is just as important as the front story, and you can't tell the two without including both of them.
Thank you, Jenny. And Leon, that really is a challenge to you because of being a cultural ambassador. A lot of your
your front story is just seed saving and crafting and this, but how is that related? I mean, how does that, where's the news in that?
One of our biggest ones actually hit internationally here a few years ago was with our Iroquois Nationals lacrosse team. We went to England. Lacrosse is our traditional sport. It came from my reservation. It's the creator's game. We went to England to play, and they says, oh, you cannot get off the plane because you're not United States citizens. We carry passports, and I showed them my passport, as we're the only ones in this country of indigenous people that have to carry a passport because we are a sovereign country. And one of the things with that is when we talk about our treaties is we live our treaties. You know, it's not a Sunday go to church. It's 24/7. It's what we do. And when we talk about lacrosse, you know, I've spoke at many colleges and stuff, and I went to Duke, talked to them, and says, I said, you guys are a disgrace. I said, lacrosse is one of our healing societies. You know, it is given to us for the men to play for the women for their strength, the strength of the children, the women, the community. And I said, you know, you've got to have these parties, and then you say, well, you know, all these guys are caught up in rape and everything else. So that's not a lacrosse player. You know, in that lacrosse and stuff, that is governed to us by the Creator. We have wampum belts that are 2,000 years old that we bring out. We've taken them to Washington, D.C. He says, here, this is our written history. You tell us that we don't have, and what we do have, says, no, here's what it is. We've taken wampum belts with the beaver tail wampum belt. It's a white wampum belt with a purple beaver tail with a slice in the middle, which gives us traditional hunting, fishing rights wherever we go. And we've taken that into courts and fought for traditional rights. And like I said before, when we go up to the attorneys and stuff and tell them, says, unless you personally have changed the Constitution in the last 5 minutes, I said, these are binding. And when those strings come out the end, they go forever. One of the things that we talk about is, you know, our passports, our standings. I said, you know, I was over in Dayton, Ohio, and we actually went to a court hearing and stuff. And I asked the judge, I says, what percentage white are you? I said, what percentage white are you? And he could not answer that. I said, you're requiring us to give who we are. I said, I want to know what percent of white are you? They were going to throw me in jail. I says, I'm just asking you a simple question. And I said, that's one of the things that we look at. When you talk about Dakota Access and a lot of these, I was back when I started, I was at Wounded Knee the first time in 68, 69. Because I remember, you know, I've been AIM member since, you know, the early 70s. I've seen a lot of that. Does anybody know what Oka is or Moss Lake?
No.
That is the longest standing encampment in this country. A Boy Scout camp and stuff that was taken over by the Mohawk people and taken back as indigenous land. And they still stand there. But a lot of that does not get covered. You look at the, we've been, you know, kind of embattled here in Pennsylvania with the pipeline going from Trenton, New Jersey to the Great Lakes. And it's all it is for them to take the Canadian tar sands overseas. That's right here in Pennsylvania. How many of you heard about that? You know, and a lot of times when we talk about our traditional rights, you know, we talk about treaties. You know, we've sat with attorneys, we sat with people, and we have attorneys that work for us. And one of the first things that we ask them is, what is the Iroquois Doctrine? And it says, your Constitution was written after the Iroquois Doctrine. You know, and when we talk about being sovereign people, you know, we are matriarchal people. To us, the women are held above everyone else in the community. And when we talk about creation, you know, we speak and we say, well, to us, God has to be female because no other man, you know, can give life. So we look at it as that they're the providers of the seed. When we talk about what George Washington and Thomas Jefferson called the skirt society, says, well, back then, says, you know, we had been governed for over 500 years by an indigenous women's society. And we don't have a problem with that. Tonawanda Seneca is still run by a chieftain society. It is still the clan mothers that make all the decisions. And where I come from, you know, the women hold all the power. When they get married, you know, the children all go through her clan. The men hold the positions, but they're only put there by the women. And if they decide that you're fit, you know, they'll remove you. If you want to make an act of war, that is up to the women. How many mothers are going to say, well, I'm going to send my kids off to war? You know, these are children that they've carried in their womb. They have that connection to. And when we talk about treaty rights, you know, when we talk about sustainability, you know, when we talk about wampum belts, you know, these are all part of who we are. When we talk about Ongahowe, when we go into places, we go to Washington, D.C. to talk, we use our indigenous language. We use the Encrater's language first, because then we'll have it translated in English. But there's a lot of things that is said in, it doesn't matter if you're from the Pueblo, if you're from Alaska, for Hawaii. The Creator's language has a lot more to say in simple words than can be translated. And we have a lot of teachings and stuff, and we talk about lost in translation. Because sometimes we can say, you know, 15 words in a statement, you know, in when you simply translate it, it's got just a short meaning. But in the Creator's language, it means so much more. Because when we're talking about who we are, we talk about matriarchal. We talk about the women, the children, you know, our families. Everything that we do has meanings for the men, women, and children, and then community. So every word has more than one meaning. And then when those are put together, that is one of the things that you see that is not there. And when you go into these places and say, well, I listen to people say, well, look at all the mess of stuff that was left, you know, after these encampments. And I just kind of laugh and says, well, if you were forced out of your house, how much are you going to take with you? You know, how much are you going to take with you? You know, and you look at, you know, the travesty and stuff that happened to the land, you know, and why it was moved and going through, you know, sacred spaces. As doing work for NAGPRA, for Native American Grave and Protection Act, we looked at maps, and it was just amazing that on these maps that the federal government has listed, it has burial sites and has religious and went right to the pipeline went right through them. I says, now this is your government that had made these maps, and now you're saying that it has no effect on indigenous life. The plants, the fish, once they started damming up these rivers, other areas that they had to push, you know, bulldozers and stuff in to back the water up so they could repair their pipeline as it's going through. You know, any other time that you go into a place and you get a bulldozer around water, you know, the DEP and everybody will be there, you know, to slap your hand and say, well, you can't do that, mm-hmm. except if it's big business. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the things that we look at is that we are indigenous 24/7. You know, we are who we are. And when we have people come into our society, you know, you may not be native, but we treat you with respect. You know, and we talk about the two-row wampum. And it says that I have my canoe and you have your canoe. As long as you follow by our rules and you stay within that path, you're welcome to stay. When a lot of these issues and stuff started, the Dutch were here 64 years before Columbus. We gave them the white root of peace. And within the white root of peace is this used as the white represents the white pine. And the white pine tree is the only tree that has four tap roots that go out in all four directions. So when we offer that white root of peace, that is endless. And once Columbus and everybody else, the Europeans, started coming, and the Dutch lived here in peace, so we offered that up to them. But the first thing they did is, you know, when people talk about even the first Thanksgiving, you know, and there's a lot of historical stories, and there's stories of what you're told in school. But, you know, the real story is quite a bit different. But one of the things that I charge people that are journalists, that are in the media, is you base your stories on facts. Is that facts convoluted by money, or is that facts written by what comes from your heart? And so with that, you know, that's a lot of what we do. You know, when we say, you know, we come here and what we do, you know, one of the big things is we don't belong to the earth. You know, we don't do this, we don't do that. And we say, no, sorry. It says, we put the earth first before us as indigenous people. You know, we look at what we are protecting is we are protecting for everyone else and their offspring. And so that's one of the big things that we look at is that, you know, that history. And then when you look at, you know, even intergenerational trauma, that there is many trials and tribulations that come from that.
Well, that was very good timing. That's not the most I could say, but that's a very good place to put an exclamation point. I let my panelists talk an extra 5 minutes, but I don't think you would have wanted me to change that. We will need to proceed, like, to lunch exactly on time at 12:15, so now we only have 25 minutes left for the rest of the discussion, but not surprisingly. I think we could also get into questions about the recently approved UN International Declaration of Indigenous Rights and how that bolsters the position of indigenous nations in protecting the land. See, this thing here is trying to tell me to speed up. Sorry. Now please say your name when you have a question, you blue badgers, and then we will repeat the question before answering it so that it will go on to the recording. All right? Who wants to go first? You, sir?
Yes. Peter Stern, U.S. Press Freedom Tracker.
Peter Stern, U.S.?
Press Freedom Tracker.
Freedom Tracker.
Press Freedom Tracker.
Yes.
I wrote about some of the journalists who were arrested at Standing Rock, including Jenny. So my question to Jenny, and also to Leon, is do you believe that journalists should cover indigenous tribes as sovereign nations?
Do you believe that journalists should cover indigenous tribes as sovereign nations? And let me mention that Jenny was supported in a letter by SEJ and other organizations to back her up when she had her freedom of the press struggle at Standing Rock.
Oh, thanks, Peter. Were you finished with your question?
I could clarify it a bit. I guess what I mean is right now, it seems like journalists tend to kind of write about indigenous peoples, and they portray the struggle as being, oh, you know, as you said, sort of sacred lands, or they try to make them out to be sympathetic victims. But would it be better or more accurate for journalists to write about issues between indigenous peoples and the government as they would write about, say, the relationship between the United States and Canada, and Canadian sort of dual citizenship, like that sort of thing.
Wonderful. Thanks, Peter, and good to see you. I appreciate the question, and in a sense, I'm going to paraphrase it in saying, should the Indigenous narrative be one which is more, I think, hinged on a political angle than, say, more on tradition and culture? Is that too simplified?
The way that, right now, journalists don't seem to cover the political aspect at all. They just say, Indigenous peoples, they're almost just American citizens who happen to live on reservations, mm-hmm. and historically they've been oppressed, mm-hmm. but there's not necessarily a sense that they are still sovereign.
Yes. Okay. And I'm so appreciative of this question because I think you get at the very heart of where we can all start moving and advancing the narrative from Standing Rock. It's one my biggest fear out of Standing Rock is that people were awake in this one beautiful moment and actually got treaty rights. Actually got what it means, the concepts of tribal sovereignty, these concepts that all too often myself as a journalist have to unpack in not just one paragraph, but two or three paragraphs, because I know that the readership is not there. There's a lot of explanatory journalism that comes with reporting from Indian country. And with Standing Rock, we crossed over that, right? People got it. Thousands, millions of people who finally understood that this water struggle was actually one that hinged on centuries-old agreements that were still in effect and these special relationships that exist between governments, tribal governments in the United States. And so to answer your question in a short view, the answer is yes. These narratives need to be portrayed in these more political framework, in my opinion, and I can speak to that in a couple of different ways, but as a Native American journalist covering Native issues, I'm often categorized as an activist anyway because I can't possibly be writing objectively or with any sort of education or intelligence beyond just writing about sacred rights or, any kind of culture or tradition, not to undermine those things. We're very proud of those things. But that's not my job. My job is to explain, unpack, sustain the knowledge that people have right now, the outside knowledge that people have, and advance that narrative. Advance the narrative that, as Tally mentioned, there's this document in the international arena called the United Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, a 30-year-long document that today is celebrating its 10th anniversary as some of the most supported arguments in an international arena that certainly has to do with protecting ceremony and rights to religion and practice of those religions. But at its core, what's most discussed is consultation, the cornerstone agreement within any kind of government-to-government interaction. Consultation, the heart of what all those treaties, those some 300 treaties that were ratified by the United States between the U.S. and the tribes. Consultation, the one thing that hung up that Dakota Access Pipeline on December 4th, 2016. It's a political issue, and just by virtue of who is and who is not considered Indigenous today, not only here in the United States, but around the world, it's a political identity. Native Americans in the United States are the only group of people of any ethnic group that has to prove their identities in the legal framework of the United States. That makes them a political identity. And because of that, it's because of those treaty agreements, those sovereign recognition that the fact that these sovereign nations have citizens. And those citizens are not just by virtue of someone wanting to come off the street and say, oh, I'm Cherokee too, because I have grandma's story behind me. I'm sure you guys have all heard that at some dinner party or another. No, citizenship, it's a political identity, not unlike Germany, not unlike Russia. We have codes that make us a political entity that goes beyond just saying that, you know, we have a blood memory and connection to the land. And I would also just say something that Leon mentioned, which I found very interesting, is, you know, these transnational corporations and their infrastructure projects, it's not just a one-off at Standing Rock. It's happening all around the world. And what is so fascinating about this narrative is that they work so meticulously to get as close as they can to segregated, demarcated boundaries like a Standing Rock without ever crossing onto the tribal border, right? Because there's so much bureaucracy involved in that. But what they're missing is that those borders are imaginary in many ways to tribes anyway, because those lands have never really been, they're not demarcated, they're stolen. They're still their indigenous lands, right? But even though that's why those camps on the borderlands of Standing Rock were so symbolic. They were taking a treaty stand, because those are historic treaty lands managed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers that were taken from the Treaty of Fort Laramie, 1868. Those are all the kind of political narratives that I think need to be reframed for journalists, any journalists going into Indian country, to go in with that framework and that understanding that these are political entities you're talking about, rather than coming in and saying these are just, you know, underrepresented indigenous peoples that have been stereotyped for so long. Thank you.
Thanks, Jenny. Do you want to comment on that too?
Yeah, one of the issues and stuff that we see with a lot of the political parts and stuff of it is that we are who we are, like I said, 24 hours a day. You know, our political life, you know, is our religious and spiritual life. You know, we are connected to the land and everything that we do. You know, it's all part of us. So if you want to segregate one part and say, well, this is going to be political and this is going to be cultural, that's not who we are. You know, and a lot of times I'm hired as a professional witness and stuff to go in as a cultural advisor. And one of the things I've seen people say, well, this is part of my religion, and one of the first things, it gets thrown out of court. But when we go in and we're talking about, you know, our treaty rights, this is who we are. You know, this is what we are. This is 24 hours a day. This is not, you know, just our religion. This is our way of life. And that's where a lot of the connection is lost, like I said, lost in translation. And when a lot of times when we have people come in to the reservation and they want to look at different parts of our society and stuff, that, you know, we try to tell them everything, all parts of our society starts with a woman, then goes to the community, then to the families, and then out. You know, we have one nucleus of who we are. And so we don't really make a division of, you know, what is political and, you know, what is traditional. So ours would be, everything would be the same, because that's who we are.
And I'll take another question right here as soon as I finish this anecdote that goes to the answer to your question, which is, and I was working at the Albuquerque Journal, and they had me covering county government to begin with, and then they moved me to city planning, and then they moved me to this other beat. It's called the federal beat. Okay, so I had those different jurisdictions to cover, and here I am in New Mexico where there's 21 Pueblo tribes, three Apache tribes, and the Navajo tribe. So they weren't being covered. Those are jurisdictions. When she says political entity, we're talking about a jurisdiction. It is that plain. These are jurisdictions that don't get covered. In Pennsylvania, there's no reservation. But and there's still treaty territory. And so when there's not a, what you can do is you can cast this to your editors in these terms, is that this is a jurisdiction that is being underserved. Yeah. We have to talk to these government officials too. They've got a branch that's the executive branch and the judicial branch and the legislative branch, just like any government does, and they're second only to the federal government in the terms of the amount of power that they have in this country, the United States. So, your question.
Yes, my name is Liza Gross. I'm an independent journalist, and I have a question, but I wanted to preface it with an anecdote, which was back in the 80s, before I was a journalist, I was trying to, and it's speaking to your point, Jenny, I was trying to get journalists interested in forced relocation that was happening, you know, in contemporary times at Big Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Dene and Hopi people were being relocated off their lands. Nobody, I could not get anybody to care. So we actually, I started telling the stories through our own Big Mountain News. And it was incredibly frustrating. Then Peter Matheson covered it, and it was the same thing. Everybody paid attention. It was a moment, and then people moved on. And I guess I wanted your both of your response to, during the plenary, when the mayor of Braddock sort of characterized Winona LaDuke and the water protectors as protesters. And I wondered if you could just sort of speak a little bit about why she had that reaction and how people can think more carefully about what that meant.
She said the plenary, but it was the opening, and unfortunately, Leon wasn't here for that, but I'm glad you brought it up because I actually wanted to bring that up here too. If all of those of you that were here definitely could feel that moment of why was her reaction so different to this Pennsylvania mayor's reaction?
Mm-hmm. I'll just give a little brief description. So it was the opening remarks, and he was the mayor of Pennsylvania mayor. He's gotten a lot of press, you know, from a lot of the kind of, I guess, big name brands out there for talking about environmental rights for his community, and I think he and Winona would probably be allies on any other basis, but he did characterize her and who's one of the most prominent and most recognizable activists for Indigenous rights today, called her a protester instead of a water protector. And I was shocked in that when those remarks were made, because it had been such an issue, right? I mean, it had become part of the repertoire of the movement at Standing Rock was that it was a deliberate outcry saying there was a huge sign, a famous photo that's out there that brands the movement, protectors, not protesters, right? And it was, and there was no question about it. Even as journalists, we had this very elongated, you know, the protesters who call themselves water protectors, right? I mean, and we still write it to this day. It's out of respect. So it was really shocking for me to hear the mayor say it in that regard, and I was not at all shocked to hear Winona respond in the way that she did. In fact, I was expecting it, and if she hadn't responded with the kind of sharpness that she did, in which she said, I'm not even a protester. Or she's, what did she, how, I'm that's right. And as if this is her profession.
Well, yeah, that's Winona LaDuke. She, for the record, recording, she has been a leader in any number of fields for many years. You know, she ran for vice president twice. So mm-hmm. That wasn't exactly a fair thing to be said there.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Right here.
Hi, I'm Emily Gertz. I'm a freelance journalist. You mentioned earlier, I think you both touched on this, that there is a tendency we have to fight to portray Indigenous communities as, you know, victims or as mystical beings. And one of the challenges I think I have encountered in doing some of that reporting, and I have written on primarily on Sami, Inupiat, and Inuit issues, is that there are disagreements between Native groups, between Native nations, between, like, for instance, in the Arctic, in Alaska, there are some communities that are for energy development in certain areas and some that are in opposition. And I feel that part of, you know, part of reporting the story, depending on the angle, is to cover that there are differences of opinion, but I'm also concerned that people think I am coming in to do like a hit job or mm-hmm. that this in some way undercuts the each side of the argument. You know, everyone feels victimized all over again, instead of humanized, which is, I guess, how I see it. I wonder what your thoughts were for journalists coming in to cover these types of issues.
Can you paraphrase the question?
Sure. Yes, I will. And I think what advice would I give to journalists coming into tribal community, of which there are, and I mean tribal community in the wider scope, in which there are various points of view intertribally? Is that, would you say?
Sure. Intertribally and intratribally.
Yes, that's correct. I would just start by saying that there are 567 federally recognized tribes in America. That number grows when you consider Canada's First Nations and Aboriginal communities. And then let's just talk about the ones who are legitimately looking for federal recognition by the federal government under state recognition practices right now. When I say that, what I mean is we're so different when you go into each one of our individual tribal communities. We are not a siloed group that sits under one umbrella category as Indigenous. And I think that that is the first thing to just always remember. At Standing Rock, it was very interesting to see who wasn't there. The Osage Nation, who is perhaps one of the most wealthiest nations, who benefits from the oil industry, right? But are they indifferent to the overall Indigenous struggle that came from that movement that represents so much more? Enforcing treaty rights? Absolutely not. But it's understanding those concepts. It's understanding all those variances and those themes and realizing that Indian country is not a one-size-fits-all narrative, right? I mean, what happens at Standing Rock is different for a tribe that is just literally 3 hours north in the MHA Nation, the Mandan Hadatsa Arikara Nation, who is servicing an entire Bakken shale field to an industry right now. And when Energy Transfer Partners and Dakota Access couldn't understand why this one tribe wasn't just going to allow that pipeline to go through, you know where they went? They went to the chairman of MHA Nation and said, "We don't understand. Can't you just go down there and tell them to, you know, just sign it over. Let us pass through." And that's a true story. Because to them, Indians are just Indians. We're all the same, right? And so let that be, just hang your hat on that every time and say they're not. It's so different. And the motives are different and the leadership is different and cultural ways and practices, they're not all the same. That's why, you know, the gathering at Standing Rock was so symbolic, because it was unified in many aspects when there is a lot of indifference in many ways. I mean, tribes are territorial people, right? They're known for lots of infighting even amongst themselves. And I think that that's why Indian country is a heavy, heavy lift, because it requires time, homework, listening, before you come in with any preconceptions.
And then another thing, Emily, is that if we have more Native Americans in our newsrooms, the burden won't be on some non-Indian who to be feeling like, you know, the problem is that I'm non-Indian when I'm writing about these different sides of the story. A Native American who's writing about a Native American issue will still have to, as Jenny can attest, deal with many sides of that coin. It's just like you're dealing with any other jurisdiction. You're going to have to.
Do you feel that people who aren't Native American eventually should not be covering these issues, and that it should be, you know, as newsrooms diversify?
No, I think we should all be a lot more. We should understand diversity a lot better. I wrote the guidebook for SEJ on diversity reporting. I think you should learn the language, you know, for example. If you're not there, if you don't know the language, learn the language. That's like
an exaggerated point, but I think Native Americans should be able to report on Japanese, for example. We should all be able to report on each other. But if you have a Native American, more Native Americans in the newsroom, you'll have more robust reporting. You want to have a next question because we're getting down to the end here.
Just real quick, Mr. Briggs, how was the Seneca getting along with the Trump administration? And Jenny, if you could, as a journalist, what have you seen on the tribes you've covered since Trump took office? What have you seen, generally speaking, as their attitude? Mm-hmm. Mr. Briggs, you could start.
With one of the issues and stuff that we have, being that we are a sovereign nation, we are 100% tax exempt, and you know we fight them all the time. The denial is the thing that we laugh about the most. And you know when they were approached by the environmental task force and stuff about, and he says, "What protest?" You know, but that's one of the things is. They used the Iroquois Doctrine and stuff to stop all hydrofracking in the state of New York. And now Trump is trying to reverse that, but he's running into a lot of adversaries in his own community. Because, you know, a lot of people are finding out what is happening now that these doors that were open, because there was a lot of basically hush-hush. And, you know, when he... they try to come up, you know, with us, and then they find out, you know, when they, like, even with the taxes, you know, they said, well, you know, we're going to stop all, you know, tax all, you know, of the European cigarettes and stuff, and then with not the non-natives. Well, then they did that, and so they found out that they went and checked all the stores that there was no non-native cigarettes in the store. So then, you know, they were banking on that extra tax money. But it's, you know, it's been common that, you know, he turns a deaf ear, and there's a lot of political things and stuff that are coming up now that, you know, it's going to have to open, and so, you know, we'll see where it goes from there. But one of the things that when you were talking about, I seen a report about up in Alaska and stuff, that almost a third of the employees for the oil pipelines and everything were Native people. And one of the guys that was talking about it was he was a Native writer and stuff. What he was saying that these companies were finding out that they take these flatlanders from the United States and send them to Alaska and they can't survive. So why not hire the people that live there? But that's the same thing that they're having problems in Standing Rock when I was at Bear Soldier in Fort Yates. And a lot of the guys that were 18 to 20s, you know, they didn't want to talk about it because that's how they were making their money. They were driving nice vehicles and stuff, but they had to go outside their community, you know, and to basically bastardize, you know, who there were of their upbringing and stuff to fight that to be able to provide for their own families. And I heard so many of the young guys saying that, you know, we're against it, but my mother needs food. My mother needs medicine. You know, that, you know, health care isn't going to cover this and their food's not going to cover this. And, you know, that's one of the biggest things that I've seen.
Okay, we've been given the sign. Do you want to?
I'll just quickly wrap it up because we'll end it on the Trump note. It's a fearful time for tribes are super afraid of Donald Trump right now. And just a quick example of that, Secretary Ryan Zinke was at the mid-year conference for the National Congress of American Indians, one of the leading advocacy organizations for tribes. And they gave him, they honored him with a blanket ceremony. If you know what that is, it's a very honorable gesture. And they put it in a way to respect, you know, his service in the military as a veteran. They had other veterans. I mean, it was one of the most upstanding ways to honor this person. But I just want to leave that picture with you in a way to say, we're just going to embrace you as carefully as we can, like a cradled baby, because there is a lot at stake right now for tribes under this administration. Thank you.
Thank you to our panelists.